Today's Issues continues on AFR with your host, Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Tim Wildman, Ed Vitagliano, Abe Hamilton, and now Steve Jordahl sits in for Fred Jackson. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning slash afternoon slash evening.
Wherever you may be.
Wherever you may be in the world listening.
Hey, we're going to wrap this discussion up on, we're going to circle back for just a moment.
Sure.
Because we were being critical of some comments by the Southern Baptist Convention President J.D. Greer in a book he wrote, which is recently released. We're not going to go over all those comments again. But we did have some of our, at least one or two of our folks say, hey, you need to invite Pastor Greer on your show. Well, we have. He won't come on.
And we have invited Russell Moore on a number of occasions.
In he won't fact, come on.
When he first became the, I guess it's the director of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
Executive director, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We actually said, listen, we're willing to go up to Nashville on our own dime and come up and talk to you because he was critical of talk radio.
Yeah,
and it was
Christian talk radio.
And we wanted to kind of clear the air. And so we have invited him on. No. He refuses. We've offered to come up there and meet with him.
Right.
He refuses. So this is not for lack of trying on our part.
No, those folks who are in that camp, would you call them the quote of the evangelical camp? Would you call them the progressives of the evangelical camp, or is that a?
I think
I don't know how
fair.
You say that.
Yeah,
The social justice warriors on the left wing, on the left side of things.
Yeah.
Now they'll be right on. They're pro-life.
Right.
They're going to say homosexuality is a sin.
Right.
They're going to be right biblically. On those kinds of things.
They're preaching and teaching.
But
I'm sure is good.
But their application in modern day America identifies with the left more than the right on big issues.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the quantity of issues that they diverge. It is on the significance of the issues that they diverge.
So, but we are an embarrassment to those people. Okay. We are.
Yeah.
Because we're the Elmer Gantries of the Christian world.
In their view, you mean?
To our Christian, to people like Russell Moore and J.D. Greer and others, we are an embarrassment because we're, the caricature that's out there of us is we're country bumpkins who don't know how to reach the world because we're hypocrites and we're bigots and we're compromised and
not irredeemably.
We're MAGA people, and all this stuff.
So, yeah, and we love America more than we love the kingdom of God.
That kind of garbage,
that kind of thing.
You hear it hurled our way. it's just ridiculous. It's not true. Anyway. So, but I just wanted folks to know that we have extended invitations to Pastor Greer and to Russell Moore to come on with us and talk about these issues and
I think we did have J.D. Greer on 4 or 5 years ago when he had a book out because we were across the street when we interviewed him.
But that was before he was El Presidente.
So he didn't mind being on our show then when
to sell a book.
that's snarky.
Can I say that out loud?
That's snarky.
Yeah.
What I was saying. That was a little bit snarky, so I apologize for that.
Okay.
I generally speaking, I like J.D. Greer in terms of his preaching and teaching, but this that we went over during the last segment I'm offended by it, and I don't think it does the Christian community any good. If you're not going to talk to us,
he's also talking about his own people.
Right.
By his own people, I mean Southern Baptist went for President Trump in overwhelming numbers because they saw what was at stake, and he's sort of the Southern Baptist Convention saying you're compromised.
He should be willing to talk to us.
Yeah,
just my 2 cents in this. We can move on, but from the
I don't think we're going to move on.
Maybe not.
We've been worked up about this. Yeah.
From the conservative Christian evangelical Bible believing perspective, the reason that this is so alarming to us is because we can draw a straight line, I think, from someone like J.D. Greer or the ERLC
Russell Moore,
where they start appropriating some of the terms from the left and progressivism straight through to someone like Jim Wallis at Sojourners, who is very liberal on everything, straight through to that, to someone like in the perhaps the Episcopal Church, where they have completely done away with biblical stuff. And we see that slippery slope. And so we're concerned for Southern Baptists, which have been, since the 1980 resurgence, which have been just the one denomination, if you set aside the non-denominational evangelical churches, the one denomination that has held true to the Word of God and to the conservative standards and to inerrancy and all this kind of stuff, now they seemingly want to go down this road. We've seen it happen so many times
before. At least the upper echelon.
Right. We've seen it happen so many times before. This is why it's so concerning. It's why it gets us upset.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and also, it's not the criticisms are not true.
Well, that too.
That's right.
They're just not true. There's no basis in reality.
J.D. Greer, in these comments to the in the interview with the Christian Post, he was criticizing something that doesn't exist.
Yes.
And then claims that's what we are.
Yes.
Straw man.
You just bingoed.
Yes.
You just bingoed. I don't think straw man's a game, but maybe it is. Can you straw man? You can bingo?
Yeah.
I'm confused at this point. I've played hangman.
You know, I try to dumb my talk down for you fellas. But there's only so much I can do. And I don't mean to sound like I'm intellectually superior, but I know it comes across that way.
Yeah.
But I can't help it. You know,
it is what it is.
When you're good, you're good. Oh, man. All right, let's move on.
All right, the state of Nevada, the Senate there has voted Tuesday by a party line vote to join the what's called the National Popular Vote Compact, Interstate Compact, which means, now this is the Senate, it has passed the House there, it is now at the governor's desk. The governor there is Governor Steve Sisolak, and he's promised to sign this thing. This will mean that in the 2016 election, if 50% of states...
2020.
In 2020, thank you, 2020, if 50% of states get to the point where they pass this, then this kicks in, and the state's entire apportionment of electoral votes goes to the winner of the national popular vote. You might remember that the last election, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Donald Trump won the electoral college vote, because that's the way he campaigned. And the one before that, they were upset because I think it was Bush that lost the popular vote, they say, to Gore. And won. And so now all the Democrats are all up in arms about this, and they want to basically do away with the Electoral College just give the winner to the popular vote. But the Electoral College, Abe, is in the Constitution. Is this constitutional?
Unfortunately, it would survive constitutional muster because the U.S. Constitution allows states the authority to determine how they allocate their electoral votes. So most listeners may be familiar with, as it stands right now, Maine and Nebraska divide the electoral votes. Okay, they do that as a result of the states passing their own laws to determine how they want to allocate their electoral votes. This National Popular Vote Compact would come into action if the total number of states that agreed to it equal a simple majority of the electoral votes, so 273 electoral votes. Now, what's fantastically idiotic about it is that you have states that are literally voting to disenfranchise their own voters. So let's say hypothetically, I'm framing it this way intentionally. Let's say hypothetically, a Republican candidate for the presidency wins the national popular vote. The state of New York, having signed on to the National Popular Vote Compact, if that becomes operational, would result in the state of New York giving all of its electoral votes to the Republican candidate for the presidency. And I'm framing it that way because surely New Yorkers don't want to do that,
right,
by and large, based on history. But that is what they are voting to do. They are literally saying it really doesn't matter what our citizens in our states want to do, as long as the majority.
You're voting I mean, but this was this a legislative move in Nevada?
It was. Yes. It is. It's it, this. The Senate House has passed it. The Senate is going to pass it. It will become the 15th state now. And I don't know the percentages, but they're coming close.
They're coming close.
Well, it'd be 195 with Nevada. It'd be 195 electoral votes.
Okay.
Would be represented by the 15 states and the District of Columbia that would have passed this.
And they only need 270.
What this is the Democrat Party saying we don't believe we'll ever lose the popular vote again because there's so many people in California and New York and Illinois, Chicago mainly, that and other places, but we don't think we'll ever lose the you know what this really does though? This really goes against the point of the Electoral College.
Yeah, they're abolishing the Electoral College basically
without amendment.
But you're saying Abe, that you're saying they can.
Yeah,
well, on a state by state basis.
Let me ask you now if a state like Maine or Nebraska they apportion. So most states have what's called a winner take all. So whatever candidate gets the popular vote in Texas gets all of their electoral college votes, with the exception of Maine and Nebraska that apportion them. But let's go back to just using Texas as an example. In Texas, you have a vote. The majority of the people vote for candidate A, and so the electoral votes go, winner take all, to that candidate. If this passes with enough states, then what you're doing is you're disenfranchising the voters in your state, and you're letting people in New York and California make your decision for you. I don't see how that's constitutional. How is that not disenfranchising the voters in Texas?
Well, it is disenfranchising the voters in Texas, but they are not technically abolishing the Electoral College. They just have persuaded, technically again, enough states to change the way they engage the Electoral College so as to accomplish the disenfranchising of the Texas voters. So it is disenfranchising them.
But how would let me use an extreme example. This would probably never happen. But let's say the legislature and the governor in Texas said, we are going to flip everyone's vote. We are passing a law. The governor's signing it. If you vote Republican, we're counting it as Democrat.
Yeah.
And we're doing that because we know more Republicans will vote in the Texas. That seems to me that would not be constitutional.
It would,
because your vote is being changed against your will. So how is this really different?
Because they're not technically changing the votes. So the vote would only, and I want everybody to be clear, I think this is a ridiculous idea, and I'm against it and I hate it, changing the National Popular Vote Compact. It's ridiculous. But they technically are not changing the individual votes. The way that the votes would be counted would be which ones are contributing to the majority of the national popular votes. So let's say Texas votes 49% for one candidate and 51% the other candidate, and the national popular vote goes with the 49% candidate. They're not technically changing the votes of individual citizens. They just didn't have enough votes for the electoral votes to go the way that 51% preferred.
One of the secrets of presidential elections is you don't really vote for the president when you cast your vote. You vote for an elector.
That's right.
And so that vote counts. Maybe it's a good idea to say why the framers put the Electoral College in the Constitution. What does it do that the popular vote doesn't?
Yeah, the Electoral College balances the interests of heavily populated states and urban centers against, as well as rural states and less populated states, so that all states have equal participation in the selection of the national executive, otherwise known as the president. What the national popular vote does, it literally would transform the political landscape to where candidates would no longer have to campaign in Iowa, in Wisconsin, in Utah, in New Mexico. They would only have to find the most populous states and only campaign there. And the reality is the states of California, New York, Florida, Illinois, Michigan, they represent enough of the population in the country that if you just win those states, you have the realistic possibility of winning the entire election.
And in fact, you would only have to campaign in Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, Houston, Atlanta, and whatever.
15, 20 cities.
And it's not just that you don't get to campaign or hear what the president has to say in those cities. It's that the candidate is going to tailor his platform to what those people are asking for. Largely, in fact, it's unflinchingly Democrat. It's unflinchingly socialist. There's a lot of social justice type stuff. There's a lot of socialism that's going on in the middle of these cities. Poverty is rampant. And so all of the stuff that the candidate is going to say, that their platform is going to be geared toward those people, and those that of us that live in Mississippi or somewhere else, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Right.
Well, yeah. And this is going to be interesting to see. If you were a voter, let's say in Nevada, for example, and you voted for president, you voted for a Republican and a Democrat won the national, but your state voted Republican, and yet your state's electors go to the one who didn't win your state. Seems like to me you're disenfranchised. You might have a case for a lawsuit there. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's what we were talking
about. But this is the Democrats. They're ticked. They've lost a couple of elections that they won popular vote, but they lost Electoral College. For the reason, and the Electoral College is there for a reason, to balance, as Abe said, the interest of big states versus rural states, and the big states still have the lion's share of,
That's the thing that's so remarkable to me. I mean, just to be candid, a Democrat candidate for the presidency starts out with about 170, 180 electoral votes.
The moment
the polls open.
Right, California, New York, Illinois.
Yeah,
you start with those states.
But that hasn't been enough.
Yeah.
Well, and let me just say this for those who say, well, it seems to me it'd be fair if you count the popular vote. It's according, for all the reasons we stated, why the Electoral College is important, but it's the rules that matter. So if you're playing three sets of tennis and you win more games, but you lose two out of three matches.
Sets, yeah.
Sets.
Right.
You lose the match.
That's right.
So you can win 6-0. And lose. I'm going to get myself in trouble here. But
I understand what you're trying to say.
The tennis is you win two out of three sets.
Right.
It doesn't matter how many games you won inside of those sets.
That's right.
Because that's not the way the rules are set up.
And frankly, this whole deal highlights the fact that constitutional illiteracy has overwhelmed the United States of America to where you have a significant percentage of our populace who doesn't even understand the Electoral College.
You ask the average American now, the younger American, the majority is majority rule. They're going to say, majority rules.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that isn't exactly how our country was set up. Majority does count, but it doesn't rule.
In fact, that's why the country's set up the way it is, because our founders looked at the Greek city-states and the Roman Republic, and they said, if you just allow pure democracy, you're going to eventually have mob rule.
Literally.
Right. All right. You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Tim with Ed and Abe, and we thank you for listening. Steve Jordahl is with us. You want to engage with the program, go to our Facebook page and type in Today's Issues, or YouTube. We're live video streaming there as well. And we hope you're having a great Wednesday. Steve, what else you got?
It is a good Wednesday. Dan Baquette, who is the executive editor of the New York Times, is warning that local newspapers and news outlets are dying, and the statistics back him up. He says that most local newspapers in America are going to die in the next 5 years, which means that there will be a lot of America in what's called a news desert. The only thing they'll have is the CNNs, Fox News, and the cable news if they have TV and cable. But local news.
Is this because of the internet primarily?
It's because it is.
The younger generation not reading newspapers.
The decline of, they're not subscribing to newspapers or reading them. That is a large part because of both cable news, the ubiquitous of it, and because of the subscription, the money isn't there. The advertising, if you don't have as many readers, you can't charge as much for advertising, and papers are expensive. Local news is kind of expensive, but I can't tell you how important local news is. All politics is local, correct? So people are much more likely to be impacted in the immediate weeks or months by what happens at their school board than they are by anything that Congress passes. Everything Congress passes, for the most part, has to go through courts. It's generally, you know, applied, and it's important. Don't get me wrong. What we do is extremely important, but local news affects people.
But aren't people who are not subscribing to newspapers saying it's not important to me?
Well,
I mean, isn't that what's happening?
Not important enough to pay for it.
They don't know that it's not important, that it is important to them. I think this is the dumbing down.
Steve knows better, Ed.
Well, no,
Steve Ocasio-Cortez? No, I'm just kidding.
No, listen, you're absolutely right.
I like local papers. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Well, you work for a local paper. I
did for a weekly paper.
I worked for when I was in college, a campus newspaper, and then I worked for a local newspaper. In fact, that was what I went to school for, was to be I was going to be probably in the newspaper business.
You know what the editor who hired me, this is way back in 85 when I worked for my first newspaper, the only newspaper I worked for full time. He told me, the owner of the paper, and in Mississippi people know Sid Salter, he's been in the newspaper business for years and years, and then the editor of the small town newspaper, weekly paper, when they interviewed me, they said, "What is the purpose of this newspaper?" And I said, it's to, you know, to give information to people and just the facts and all that kind of stuff. They said, nope, this newspaper exists to make money. They said it's a business. And so part of your responsibility, you know, getting ads and stuff like that, the newspaper has to make money and it's a business. And I never forgot that. And this is what's affecting these local papers, is they're not making enough money.
It can be both ends.
Listen, but he was saying this is a business, and so we make decisions to promote the business.
I think that the circulation for local newspapers is declining because of the digital age and the younger generation. By younger generation, I don't know where you put that, under 35 or something like that. Not brought up on newspapers.
Right.
You know, when I was a kid, you were a kid, Ed. I mean, we read, the newspaper came to our house, and I look forward to it.
Yeah.
I mean, especially the sports section. Sports first, and then if there's nuclear war, I'll read about that. I'll read about that after oatmeal. But first of all, I'm going to read about the sports world, because that's the most important thing.
Right.
But, and sports, local sports still is a big part of the newspaper business, because you can't get that on CNN, Fox News, or anywhere else. So it'll be interesting, but I don't think local newspaper, I don't know if they'll completely die, but it's just a different time we live in, and people get their news and information, and I'm not so sure, you know, that generation I've just described, they care about the school board meeting so much. And what you get, and I know people get, there's good reporters and bad reporters at local newspapers, but the point, I think the New York Times editor there was making, was you do get some level of accountability if you have a strong, vibrant local newspaper. Is the school board doing, what are they doing?
Yeah.
Who's reporting on them? Who's going, you know, who's asking the hard
accountability?
Asking the hard questions? So we're out of time here. But anyway, interesting. Is there a story for tomorrow that we're?
Oh, we have to. Tomorrow will bring its own stories. We'll have plenty of them, yes.
Okay. Hey, folks, we're going to Israel in March, and we'd love for you to go with us. If you've always wanted to go to the Holy Land, well, maybe this is your time. Go to the website, twholyland.com. I'm leading this tour with my wife, Allison. twholyland.com. And if you'll go there, you can print the brochure out. You can read all about it if you want to go with us in March. To Israel. We'd love to have you. Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Hey, appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ed, thank you for your insights.
They were insightful.
And thank you for your shirt.
And yes. And thank you, Brent. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.